Chapter 9. Actual Minds, Actual Words. Perhaps the most stunning fact about eliminationist and exterminationist politics is that the perpetrators almost always get their victims. In few social and political endeavors of comparable scale are the goals so regularly and fully achieved. Indeed, large eliminationist onslaughts, as we now know, usually begin only when the perpetrators are confident of success, owing to the overwhelmingly superior force they can unleash against defenseless people. More easily than the German army swept away the archaic Polish army in September 1939, the perpetrators, steamrolling stunned civilian populations, kill and eliminate a strikingly high percentage of their intended victims, often approaching 100%. We know this because indications of failure, substantial armed resistance, perpetrator casualties, mass escapes that are not effectively expulsions, rarely exist. Thus, unlike with other state policies, what produces an eliminationist policy's successful implementation is not the issue. Instead, it is, what do the perpetrators want to do and why? Perpetrators want, and their ensuing acts are themselves embedded in a larger transformative agenda of recasting and refashioning their world. What kinds of worlds do the perpetrators seek to create? What worlds do they make? Eliminationist politics is a politics of radical refashioning. Those pursuing it seek to transform societies and politics by eradicating populations, recasting power relations, and homogenizing culture, values, and practices. The perpetrators thoroughly alter their domain, locally, nationally, regionally, or globally, leaders and followers swaggering godlike to transform their world as folk myths have gods do. Nikita Khrushchev, Joseph Stalin's successor, recounts Stalin's words upon deciding to move against Yugoslavia. "All I have to do is wiggle my finger and there will be no more Tito." Khrushchev adds, "He didn't succeed in the case of Tito, but inside our country he butchered and annihilated millions of people." German planners in the Ministry for the Occupied Eastern Territories, animated by their politics' untrammeled eliminationist spirit, drew up blueprints to deport to not-yet-conquered Siberia 31 million of the 45 million inhabitants of large swaths of Eastern Europe, including Poland, Ukraine, and the Baltics, noting almost in passing the extermination of the region's 5 million to 6 million Jews. Eli Ingarambi describes the Hutus' euphoric sense at refashioning their world. "But everyone who was a Hutu at that time during that regime, he thought of himself as strong. He thought he was on the top. He even thought that nothing would touch him. He even thought that death would not come down on him and kill him. He was hearing people, Tutsi, dying on the hill, cries of agony, noises, people, and he was thinking he was powerful. I think he thought that there were no consequences. He thought he was successful. He thought that nothing would happen to him. He thought there was nothing. Nothing would happen to him or nothing would touch him. So, he thought, only that one is supposed to die, and that the death would never approach him." Many ancient myths are Manichaean tales of good and evil, creation and destruction, joy and suffering, and the world's shaping and reshaping. Such myths resonate with many perpetrators' self-conceptions, vaulting aspirations, and omnipotent powers to obliterate entire peoples, as Turks thought about Armenians, Germans about Jews, and Hutu about Tutsi. They resonate with why and what the perpetrators do to alter the world. They resonate with the perpetrators' dual sense of acting in goodness's cause and without restraint. Human conduct's ordinary rules do not apply. Volcanic violence and the eradication of peoples ensues. What could be more godlike? Seeing the perpetrators as godlike and world refashioners is still more apt for those self-consciously acting in a deity's name, often a secular god, in order to serve their people, purify them, hasten the end of days, prevent the apocalypse. While perpetrators are focused on the enemy before them, the individual Herero, Armenian, Jew, Pole, Korean, Kulak, Chinese, Kikuyu, Communist, Bangladeshi imperialist, Maya, Kurd, Bosnian, Tutsi, Hutu, or infidel, they concentrate on the immediate task. Yet they also know that their eliminationist politics refashions their world. They discuss it. They see it. They understand how they do it. From top to bottom, eliminationist perpetrators refashion the world, yet the transformations do not all have the same effects or origins. Understanding the actual refashionings requires us to look to the perpetrators' actual mindsets, to their conceptions of what they want, including, crucially, their conceptions of the victims whom the perpetrators wrongly understand as the causes of their actions. Author's note: although perpetrators' intentions are not relevant for defining mass murders and eliminations, they are critical for the different task of explaining eliminationism's various outcomes. I examine here four of the central refashionings of eliminationist perpetrators. I start with their most general reshaping of the world, their overall treatment and variation in treatment of different victim groups, including relative mortality rates. Actual minds do create different eliminationist worlds. I then move to a critical, under-investigated theme: how actual minds create different communal worlds, namely the perpetrators' communities. The perpetrators have a ready-made new social world, their eliminationist institutions. Beyond them, the perpetrators are embedded in a series of broader communities, including national communities, each a world of relations, sometimes overlapping, sometimes discrete, which the perpetrators alter to varying degrees. One such communal world, the camp world, bears special attention, as perpetrators are its founders. Actual minds create different camp worlds. For the perpetrators, a new societal system, and for the victims, a new immiserating world. Why do they create this new world, and how do different camp systems function? Finally, at the most personal, elemental level, actual minds create different personal worlds. The perpetrators refashion their own and their victims' individual worlds with their personalized treatment of every individual, especially with their mind and body-destroying cruelty. Perpetrators' different actual minds produce different eliminationist politics, creating different actual worlds. Eliminationist worlds. When political leaders activate eliminationist beliefs and their bearers are ready to act on their logic, two things conjoin to greatly influence what happens. The perpetrators, and especially the leaders' conception of the victims, dehumanized or demonized, and the nature of their threat, and their political goals, including for social and political transformation. The perpetrators' thinking about the world in itself produces substantial variation in their reshaping of it, in their treatment of victims and potential victims. Different eliminationist regimes' perpetrators differently dispose of victim groups, and a single eliminationist regime's perpetrators also often treat different victim groups dissimilarly. We can further examine these variations by looking at certain regimes, conventionally called totalitarian, that, in seeking to refashion society or the multitude of societies, have initiated vast domestic and international eliminationist programs to exert total control, purify, fend off the apocalypse, bring about the promised paradisial future. Within the Germans' empire, the differential treatment of the peoples of different races, biologies, and allegiances varied on so many dimensions that just a few examples must suffice. Beginning with the most obvious but wholly overlooked issue never accorded its critical analytical significance, are the peoples Germans marked or did not mark for eliminationist treatment. Neither the German leadership nor those implementing policies treated all conquered peoples similarly. Against the French, Germany's greatest and most dangerous enemy, the Germans did not undertake a mass eliminationist assault. In 70 years, they had fought three major wars. In World War I, Germany suffered a devastating and humiliating military defeat, followed by the Versailles Treaty's ignominious post-war settlement, which Germans principally blamed on the French. Germany had to cede substantial regions to various countries, including Alsace-Lorraine to France, and the Saar to a 15-year League of Nations mandate, which meant French occupation until 1935. Germany had to pay economically crippling reparations to France, and owing to conflicts over reparations in 1923, France occupied and pillaged Germany's industrial heartland, the Ruhr, producing Germany's most ruinous economic disaster ever, hyperinflation. 1 trillion marks equaled $1. During World War II, the German occupation of France was severe, but Germany did not even initially occupy all of France, granting its southern part formal independence with its own, albeit puppet, government in Vichy. The Germans did not systematically exterminate the French, save French Jews. French life, society, and culture continued. Flanking Germany to the east, as France did to the west, was militarily anemic Poland. Poles had not caused Germany and Germans a hundredth of the conflict, loss of life, and suffering the French had. For decades, France loomed largest in Germany's geostrategic and military thinking as a concern and an actual martial antagonist. Poland and Poles were a comparative afterthought, having not even existed as an independent country for 100 years. The Versailles Treaty resurrected it, ceded it German territories, thus giving Germany one realistic antagonism against Poland paralleling France. Yet, unlike the Germans' conventional, if exploitive and brutal, occupation of France, the Germans articulated and practiced thoroughgoing eliminationist politics against the Polish people and were turning Poland into a giant concentration camp. They slaughtered segments of the Polish elite and many other Poles, in addition to the nearly completed extermination of Poland's 3 million Jews, and were reducing those Poles they would not kill or expel into helots, beings toiling in abject servitude and slavery. Martin Bormann, Adolf Hitler's chief of staff, in 8 Principles for the Government of the Eastern Territories, summarized Hitler's views on the Poles and other Slavic peoples' futures the Germans were creating. The Slavs are to work for us. Insofar as we don't need them, they may die. Therefore, compulsory vaccination and German health services are superfluous. The fertility of the Slavs is undesirable. They may use contraceptives and practice abortion, the more the better. Education is dangerous. It is sufficient if they can count up to 100. At best, an education is admissible which produces useful servants for us. Every educated person is a future enemy. Religion we leave to them as a means of diversion. As to food, they are not to get more than necessary. We are the masters. We come first. The Germans' vastly different treatment of the French and the Poles had nothing to do with war, nothing to do with each people's respective enmity for Germans or suffering they had caused Germans, nothing to do with the intensity of the ethnic conflicts, nothing to do with Germans' psychological reaction to fortune, whether good or bad, and nothing to do with their expectations or the realities of either people's resistance. The Germans' different treatment of the French and Poles had nothing to do with these or the other structural explanations denying the perpetrators agency and the critical, almost all-defining element, the Germans' racial biological conception of each national group. Indeed, such structural explanations suggest that had the Germans subjected one of the peoples to an eliminationist assault, they would have targeted the French. But the Germans did the opposite. Why? From Hitler on down, Germans considered the French, though enemies, part of the human family, but the Poles a subhuman race, rightless beings for the master race to use or eliminate as necessary. Even more acutely, the related question poses itself. Why did the Germans slate the defenseless Jews for total extermination? Many Jews were themselves devoted and loyal Germans. Non-German Jews, many Germanophiles, loved German culture, teaching their children German. Unlike the French, they harbored no enmity for and had never harmed Germany. Surveying Europe, the Germans' treatment of conquered peoples in overall policy and by the ordinary Germans on the ground accorded with the Germans' notions of different races and peoples and about individual and group biology, which bizarrely came down to stature, physiognomy, coloration, and notions about blood. They privileged tall, blonde, and blue-eyed, thin-faced people. They valued peoples or races in particular, and then individuals within different races, mainly according to the people's proximity to or distance from this racist ideal. The Germans treated the Nordic peoples, such as Danes, the best, Western Europeans the next best, Southern Europeans worse, but still much better than Slavic peoples, whom they treated most brutally and murderously, except for peoples Germans deemed racially or biologically polluted or dangerous, mentally ill and developmentally disabled people, Sintes, Romas, and the Jews. Any theory or explanation of mass murder or elimination must account for the Jews' singular position among eliminationism's victims during our time and throughout history. Jews have been eliminationist politics' most frequent and varied victims, victimized longer by the most diverse groups of perpetrators and in the most countries. Speaking this obvious truth about the Jews' singularity as victims does not make their mass murder or eliminationist persecutions factually or morally worse. It merely establishes factual differences and that any general account must prominently deal with the singularity. Furthermore, because so many states, regimes, and peoples have practiced eliminationism toward Jews in so many forms, the Jews' fate provides particular insight into eliminationist politics and assaults. Just as the Nazis were our time's most omnivorous and versatile mass murderers and eliminators, their principal, most passionately pursued victims, the Jews, are unparalleled among eliminationist onslaught's victims. More specifically, 1. The Holocaust is our time's only mass murder where the perpetrators consciously sought, even declaring as much, the total extermination of the targeted group, without exception, everywhere, even if their immediate operational plans were mainly restricted to the entire European continent. Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, in a self-congratulatory speech in 1943 to the assembled governmental and Nazi party leaders, at once echoed their common beliefs and articulated the imperative guiding their ongoing campaign. This people must disappear from the face of the earth. 2. The Holocaust is the only mass murder the initiating perpetrators carried out outside their country, not aimed at territorial aggrandizement or consolidation. 3. Aside from a few other groups the Nazis targeted, the Holocaust is the only mass murder without any foundation in realistic conflict. 4. The Holocaust is the only mass murder assented and contributed to by significant portions of many different national, ethnic, and religious groups, some themselves being attacked by the Germans, and in which coalitions of governments participated in an international genocidal alliance. 5. The Jews are the only group against whom there has been and continues to be, among political Islamists and many Arabs, an ongoing eliminationist politics, including exterminationist moments, across centuries, even millennia, perpetrated by enormously varied regimes, political movements, and peoples. These eliminationist politics have also spanned three continents and found grounding in two major religions, Christianity and Islam, and the world's principal secular religion, Marxism. 6. The Jews are the only people attacked for being wealthy and being poor, for being stateless and having a state, for remaining separate from countries' majority groups and assimilating into them, for being religious and being secular. 7. The profound anti-Jewish prejudice known as anti-Semitism, whatever its sometimes substantial variations, is the only discourse, ideology, hatred, that was and is truly transnational and woven into modern as well as pre-modern civilization's very fabric. Hence the eliminationist assault upon Jews, transnationality, and endurance. The distinctiveness of the Germans' total annihilationist assault upon the Jews in itself shows that the German conception of peoples and groups, also shaping the Germans' political, including imperial, designs, explains not only whom they targeted, Jews and Poles, and did not target, Danes and French, for eliminationist politics. It also explains the Germans' differing eliminationist means and treatment of the various peoples they did choose to target in eliminationist onslaughts. Sociologist Anna Pawelczyska, a Polish survivor of Auschwitz, explains, "A prisoner's nationality and citizenship became a differentiating criterion with far-reaching consequences for his or her chances of surviving. Replacing national distinctions, pseudoscientific theories of race began to take drastic effect by ranking the different nationalities of prisoners, thus spelling out for them their turns to die. That ranking decidedly foredoomed their chances of survival. First place in this sequence of dying was assigned to prisoners of Jewish descent and gypsies. And the proof was their mass murder through the use of assembly line techniques. Slavs, especially Poles and Soviet citizens, were put in second place. The expressions of this were the various methods of murder used against them at different times, and the unrealized program of general sterilization. Third came the other nations of Europe, for whom, as the documents show, the programs of extermination or exploitation had not been precisely established. Only prisoners of German nationality were excluded from this plan. For this and various other reasons, the odds for their survival were considerably greater than those of other prisoners." The Germans' conception of various peoples and groups is the only adequate explanation for which peoples the Germans exterminated totally or partially, and if partially, to what degree, for which peoples the Germans were helotizing, and how they prioritized their eliminationist assaults. It is the only adequate explanation for the relative death rates of different peoples in structurally similar situations, as the Mauthausen camp figures cited in Chapter 4 show. And, as I discuss shortly, the Germans' treatment of different peoples' children and relative cruelty toward different victim peoples. It is the only adequate explanation for the Germans' use of non-exterminationist means when dealing with other putatively lesser beings or lesser threats, and that while all other eliminationist perpetrators also employ various eliminationist means and partial assaults on their victims, the Germans always deemed non-lethal measures against the Jews inadequate, unless as a stepping stone, which is how the Germans usually conceived of them, to utter extermination. Friedrich Ubelhor, the top civil administrator in the Łódź district of Poland, articulated this when discussing the eventually highly productive Łódź ghetto's establishment. "The creation of the ghetto is, of course, only a transition measure. I shall determine at what time and with what means the ghetto, and thereby also the city of Łódź, will be cleansed of Jews. The final goal, at any rate, must be that we burn out this bubonic plague utterly." The final goal. Bubonic plague. Burn it out. Utterly. He might have added, for the history of eliminationist assaults, "only by the Germans and only for the Jews." Finally, and also analytically ignored, the Nazis failed to treat their real and dangerous domestic enemies as every structural theory and every theory of totalitarian politics mandates. The German political left, especially communists, were the Nazis' bitter enemies, having fought them in the Weimar Republic's streets and after World War I taken power temporarily with a revolutionary insurgency in Bavaria. The German left had a million-fold large, disciplined, and martial followership. Yet the Nazis did not proceed, as communist totalitarian regimes did, to systematically eliminate their real enemies. The Soviets established their initial terror and gulag for their czarist and other enemies. The Nazis killed comparatively few among these real domestic enemies, even among their leadership, and left their millions of followers all but unscathed, relatively unmolested, unmonitored, unthreatened. Yet in the Soviet Union's western regions, the Germans did the opposite, extirpating the bearers of Soviet communism, which they conceived of as Jewish Bolshevism, a Jewish-created and controlled ideological disease and threat. Why the difference? Why yet another instance of an eliminationist assault's absence, especially given the Nazis' unequaled readiness to practice eliminationist politics? The Nazis' racism deemed some peoples noble, meaning that German communists and socialists, members of the master race, when freed of the putative poisonous influence of the Jews and of their communist ideological leaders, would be cured, embrace Nazism, and help build the Nazi Germanic Empire and future. As in almost every critical respect, here Hitler and the Nazi leaders knew their people well, correctly expecting that most of the political left shared their racist views and willingly contributed to the Jews' elimination and Europe's conquest and subjugation. The communist Khmer Rouge resembled the Germans in much of Europe by turning Cambodia into a gargantuan camp, though the Khmer Rouge exerted a thorough totalitarian penetration of social life that other regimes seeking total control only dream of, and to which the Nazis never aspired or came close to achieving. For non-Jewish, non-gay, non-Gypsy Germans, the Nazis allowed a surprising degree of freedom. The Khmer Rouge, like the Nazis, designated a range of ideological enemies considered, to various degrees, polluted racially and by foreign acculturation, and also differently dangerous to the Khmer Rouge and the pure Khmer Cambodian people. Even though the Khmer Rouge controlled all Cambodians equally, their eliminationist orientation, like that of the Germans, played itself out markedly differently with different groups. The Khmer Rouge wanted to utterly purify the Khmer people according to their anti-modern, racist, Marxist ideological amalgam, calling for primitive socialist equality and conformity. This accounts for their hatred of urban life and their intention that only racially pure Khmer live within Cambodia. The Khmer Rouge sought to reduce or destroy the country's putative, polluted essence by eliminating all people of non-Khmer races, religions, locales, and allegiance. Theirs was to be the most thoroughgoing and rapid eliminationist transformation yet. In September 1975, the Khmer Rouge leaders told Cambodia's former ruler, Prince Norodom Sihanouk, they wanted to outdo their role models, the communist Chinese. "We want to have our name in history as the ones who can reach total communism with one leap forward. So we have to be more extremist than Madame Mao Zedong and the Cultural Revolution leadership in China. We want to be known as the only communist party to communize a country without a step-by-stop polity, without going through socialism." In 1976, the Khmer Rouge expressed similar aspirations and self-praise in their government's newspaper, criticizing the Vietnamese communists as too slow. "The Khmer method has no need of numerous personnel. We've overturned the basket and with it all the fruit it contained. From now on, we will choose only the fruit that suits us perfectly. The Vietnamese have removed only the rotten fruit, and this causes them to lose time." On the radio, the Khmer Rouge broadcasted their guiding ideological maxims, including, "What is infected must be cut out," and "What is too long must be shortened and made the right length." As the Khmer Rouge wanted only people suiting them perfectly, the range and number of those infected or too long needing to be cut out or shortened was expansive. The Khmer Rouge's ideology held modern and urban life to be inauthentically Khmer. In their first act to overturn the entire fruit basket, within days of taking power, they began to eliminate people from cities, driving millions on death marches to inhospitable rural destinations. The Khmer Rouge, the modern world's most extreme levelers, then subjected Cambodians to an ideologically driven, brutal regimen expressing the radical eliminationist orientation that made Cambodia our time's most murderous small country. Arn Yan, a survivor, explains the Khmer Rouge's doctrine gave us no human rights, no sympathy, and no freedom to do anything. The Khmer Rouge treated any failure to conform, however inadvertent or unavoidable, as a willful assault upon the regime. That is why, as Yan recalls, sometimes we would make only a small mistake, but they pointed us out to the killers and we would be killed. Nevertheless, the Khmer Rouge's lethality varied greatly from different Cambodian groups, flowing, as it did, from the leaders and their followers' differing conceptions of those groups. This included their fundamentally differentiated conception and treatment of base people, also known as old people, those under the Khmer Rouge's territorial control prior to their final military conquest of all Cambodia, whom the Khmer Rouge therefore favored, and of new people, those falling into the Khmer Rouge's hands with the final victory, and therefore, only due to this small temporal difference, not an ethnic difference, deemed far less reliable. Under the Khmer Rouge, approximate death tolls and mortality figures were new people. Of 2 million urban Khmer, 25% or 500,000 perished. Of 600,000 rural Khmer, 25% or 150,000 perished. Of 430,000 urban Chinese, 50% or 215,000 perished. Of 10,000 urban Vietnamese, 100% perished. Of 10,000 rural Lao, 40% or 4,000 perished. Of the 3,050,000 total new people, 29% or 879,000 perished. Base people. Of the 4.5 million rural Khmer, 15% or 675,000 perished. Of the 5,000 Khmer Krom, 40% or 2,000 perished. Of the 250,000 rural Kham, 36% or 90,000 perished. Of the 10,000 rural Vietnamese, 100% perished. Of the 20,000 rural Thai, 40% or 8,000 perished. Of the 60,000 upland minorities, 15% or 9,000 perished. Of the 4,840,000 total base people, 16% or 792,000 perished. Of these 7,890,000 people living in Cambodia, 21% or 1,671,000 people died. This regime's murderousness, like the Nazis, was clearly differentiated and targeted according to its conception of the victims. Chuhun Van explains that the old people, they have more rights, they have more freedom, they have enough food to eat. They have a good doctor to treat them when they get sick, but the new people, never. They treat the new people like animals. The Khmer Rouge killed base or old people and new people at very different rates. The mortality rate among the new people was 80% greater. For the rural Khmer alone, the most privileged social category, the Khmer Rouge killed those deemed new at a 2/3 greater rate than those deemed old. And much testimony from survivors verifies that these differential numbers also reflected the Khmer Rouge perpetrators' much greater harshness and brutality and outright murderousness toward the new people. Tita Butt Mom, a survivor, conveys the Khmer Rouge's mindset. The people on the Khmer Rouge death list were the group called the City People. They were the New People. These were any Cambodian men, women, girls, boys, and babies who did not live in their liberated zones before they won the war in 1975. Their crime was that they lived in the enemy's zone, helping and supporting the enemy. The city people were the enemy, and the list was long. Former soldiers, the police, the CIA, and the KGB. Their crime was fighting in the Civil War. The merchants, the capitalists, and the businessmen. Their crime was exploiting the poor. The rich farmers and the landlords. Their crime was exploiting the peasants. The intellectuals, the doctors, the lawyers, the monks, the teachers, and the civil servants. These people thought, and their memories were tainted by the evil Westerners. Students were getting education to exploit the poor. Former celebrities, the poets. These people carried bad memories of the old, corrupted Cambodia. The list goes on and on. The rebellious, the kind-hearted, the brave, the clever, the individualists, the people who wore glasses, the literate, the popular, the complainers, the lazy, those with talent, those with trouble getting along with others, and those with soft hands. These people were corrupted and lived off the blood and sweat of the farmers and the poor. Very few of us escaped these categories. No data capture the mortality rate of people the Khmer Rouge considered particularly westernized, the highly educated and professionals, especially ideologically polluted and dangerous. Yet much testimony indicates the perpetrators were particularly brutal and murderous toward them, targeting them initially for extermination. The Khmer Rouge's racism, wedded to its apocalyptic vision of Cambodia's current situation and future, inspired them to adopt a near-total eliminationist policy against non-Khmer races and people putatively bearing non-Khmer cultural sources. This was presaged in the regime's ideological declaration that ethnic minorities, more than 15% of Cambodia, composed only 1% of the population, an error likely reflecting the Khmer Rouge's racist and cultural eliminationist politics intent rather than a wildly poor demographic estimate. Conceiving of people with skin lighter than the dark, putative, pure Khmer as corrupted, the Khmer Rouge sought to eliminate them. Molly Lee recalls that one day, about 50 families were transferred to another district. A few days later, it was revealed by the local soldiers that these families had Vietnamese blood and for that reason were put to death. I lost quite a few friends. Most of them were Chinese Cambodians. The complexion of their skin was only a little lighter than mine. This was one small moment in the Khmer Rouge's campaign to eradicate ethnic Vietnamese Cambodians. Upon taking power, they expelled 85% of them and then annihilated all remaining 20,000. By 1979, no ethnic Vietnamese remained alive in the country. The Khmer Rouge's eliminationist campaign included exterminating the Khams, an indigenous people deemed doubly suspect due to their distinct ethnicity and Islamic faith. They expelled the Khams from their 113 villages, murdering 100,000 and sprinkling the remaining 150,000 in small groups around the country. They slaughtered the Khams' leaders and elites, banned their foreign language, and prohibited Islam. One Kham peasant explains, "Some Kham villages completely disappeared. Only two or three people remained. We were persecuted much more than Khmers." They killed about 40% of other ethnic minorities, Chinese, Laotians, and Thais. They appear to have entirely obliterated one people, the Kola, numbering perhaps 2,000. They considered Buddhist monks the bearers of an alien religious incrustation upon Cambodians. It may be that only 3% of 70,000 monks survived. The Khmer Rouge's murderousness and brutality varied regionally. On the ground, local perpetrators greatly affect targeted people's fate. The Khmer Rouge leadership's infighting for power and position also led to differential murderousness and some internal purges. Nevertheless, the overall and highly differentiated eliminationist assaults upon the different discrete groups is unmistakable, driven by the Khmer Rouge's conception of humanity and of the existing and desired Cambodian politics and society. They wanted to eliminate the categories of urban dwellers and urban life. Indeed, they seemed to want to eradicate urban life's very notion, so they emptied the cities, towns, and even villages. They beheld the Vietnamese as the Khmer's ancient foe to be totally eradicated, so they expelled most and slaughtered the rest. They especially targeted elites, including Khmer's, for extermination. They exterminated non-Khmer religious bearers, both Buddhist and Islamic, almost completely. The relationship between intent and action here is ironclad and unmistakable. Eerily reminiscent of the German leadership's discussion at the Wannsee Conference of their already operational plans to exterminate European Jewry, Pol Pot laid down the general contours of the Khmer Rouge's eliminationist program at the five-day meeting. Monks had to be wiped out. The Khams, as a putatively foreign and an Islamic people, had to be utterly eliminated as a people, with a large percentage slaughtered and the rest expelled, scattered, and repressed. The remaining Khmer, differentiated in Khmer Rouge thinking, needed their ranks radically thinned, albeit at a much lower rate, which amounted to this backward-looking Marxist-racist regime and its adherents murdering a still stunning 15% to 25% in less than 5 years. Had the 100,000 or so Vietnamese the Khmer Rouge chose to eliminate through expulsion resisted and tried to stay in their homes, the Khmer Rouge certainly would have slaughtered every last one, just as they killed all the remaining Vietnamese, in which case they would have murdered not 20,000, but 120,000. This is, among our time's many other instances, an unambiguous example of eliminationist means interchangeability, the perpetrators deeming expulsion and killing equivalent substitutes and solutions to the same problem. This again underscores that examining mass killing in isolation of other eliminationist acts fundamentally fails to specify the real political and social phenomenon and inherently produces erroneous analyses and conclusions. Because the Khmer Rouge differentiated Cambodia's people according to ascriptive and racist categories, they generally did not distinguish among men and women or adults and children. To them, each person's nature was principally determined not by his or her deeds or threats or by individual acculturation or stances, but by the perpetrator's social and political mapping of each person's group membership. The Khmer Rouge conceived of westernized people, the racially impure and others, as carriers of germs. Their imputed corruption was infectious, an incurable, dangerous virus threatening everyone. Thus, the Khmer Rouge leaders urged their followers to cut down and uproot not only those whose putative nature or actions earned them this fate, but also their children. Just as the peoples and groups a given eliminationist system's perpetrators choose to target vary, and just as the perpetrators' relative lethality toward different target groups varies, death rates also vary enormously from one eliminationist system to the next. Because mass annihilation and elimination are purposeful and discretionary political acts, such systems' variable overall destructiveness needs to be explained rather than ignored, taken for granted as such systems' natural feature, or treated as structural features of such systems, regimes, the international order, etc. Take five major eliminationist political systems oriented toward refashioning their domestic or regional worlds with a sustained eliminationist orientation and programs: the Communist Chinese, Soviet, Nazi Germany, Imperial Japanese, and Khmer Rouge. Although establishing a firm numerical basis for comparison is hard, because death tolls are imprecise and the adequate metric, owing to the vastly differently sized and, in some cases, rapidly changing populations under each regime's control, is difficult to establish, some instructive conclusions can be drawn. Even if a higher estimate is correct that the Soviets killed on the order of 20 million people during their 35 years of mass murdering, the yearly average would be close to 600,000 people. If the lower 8.5 million estimate is correct, the yearly average would be 250,000. The communist Chinese killed on the order of 50 million during their 26 years of systematic mass murdering that coincided with Mao's reign, so approximately 2 million a year. This excludes the Chinese's longer and annually less deadly eliminationist campaign in Tibet, which, if included, would substantially reduce the yearly average. The Japanese annihilated on the order of 6 million people during their 8 years of mass murdering, a yearly toll of 750,000. A higher estimate of 10 million makes the yearly average 1.2 million. The Khmer Rouge killed by far the highest percentage of their small dominions people, roughly 20%, though the yearly total was less than these other regimes, about 400,000. The Germans killed on the order of 15 million people during their 4 years of systematic mass murdering, making them by far the most intensive mass murderers at almost 4 million annually. Even if we date their systematic mass murdering from the war's beginning in 1939 rather than the implementation of their coincident decision in 1941 to systematically slaughter the Jews and attack the Soviet Union, this still yields the highest yearly mass murder rate at 2.5 million. The Germans' extermination of the Jews at 1.5 million per year makes just this aspect of their mass murdering more annually annihilationist than the other regime's total mass murdering, except for that of the communist Chinese. The Germans' murderousness of the Jews was so intensive, even before they had moved to their eliminationist assault's explicit total exterminationist phase, that had the communist totalitarian regimes adopted that killing rate, the percentage of total inhabitants killed per year, they would have reached their actual victim totals much sooner. At the Germans' killing rate, mainly through starvation, in the Warsaw Ghetto Camp, which shortly after its establishment with about 500,000 Jews was about 1% per month or more than 10% per year, the Soviets would have killed all their victims, depending on the estimate, in about half a year to 1 year instead of 35. The communist Chinese would have needed a little more than a half year, not a quarter century. Even the thoroughly merciless Khmer Rouge would have murdered all their victims in less than half the actual time. Why did the Germans' annual mass murder rate exceed, indeed dwarf, the others' already colossal rates? Author's note. Accounting for population size, the Germans' rate compared to that of the second largest per year killers, the communist Chinese, becomes enormously greater. The Chinese dominion contained more than 700 million people, 2 to 5 times that of the Germans, fluctuating with the war's course, during their most intensive mass murdering. Unlike that of the various communist murderers and the Japanese, the Germans' creed was explicitly annihilationist. As a core matter of ideology and policy, it called for the elimination with a lethal reflexiveness of tens of millions, eventually probably hundreds of millions, of people. Unlike the communists, the Germans did not want to rehabilitate people they incorporated through conquest, because they grounded most of their victims' undesirability in their imputed racial and biologically based inferiority and perniciousness. The Germans' proactive plans to annihilate an itemized list of more than 11 million Jews, their official programs to slaughter those they deemed mentally ill and developmentally disabled, their general exterminationist drive against Sintis and Romas, their wanton murder of millions in Poland and the Soviet Union fundamentally differentiated them in 2 respects from the communists. First, when the Nazis and all those Germans following them surveyed the map of Europe and beyond, they saw peoples to be destroyed, violently subjugated, enslaved, or somehow eliminated. When the communists gazed upon their relevant maps, they did not particularly covet others' territory or think it must be cleared of human impediments. They did not see peoples in all directions to be destroyed. But they did see people they had to transform to fit their mold, which meant possibly sacrificing a substantial number for the greater good. Indeed, their Marxist social theory, whatever its substantial pathologies and inhumanity, sought positive social transformation through economic restructuring and change. They did not, as the Nazis did, study these maps with murder in their eyes. The second difference followed from the first: killing's motive and consequent manner. The communists, though not the Japanese, killed human beings in their understanding of humanity's cause with a beneficent vision of a communist future for all humanity, thriving, having plenty, and living in freedom and harmony. This vision of humanity was an ideologically driven fantasia, and therefore foundationally unreal and unrealizable, requiring inhumane means with inhumane, indeed catastrophically inhumane, results. But this is a far cry from the Germans' annihilationist ethos and practice, seeking to place one race above all others, to refashion all human society according to a racial, biological, draconian caste and slave system, and to kill vast numbers practically for its own sake. Hence the Germans' far greater murderousness, its different quality. Slaughtering people on a scale unparalleled in human history came to the Germans during the Nazi period as easily and reflexively as swatting flies. The Germans actively killed most of their victims as part of an explicit exterminationist policy by shooting, gassing, and purposely starving them to death. The communists killed most or even the vast majority of their victims with catastrophic, ideologically induced and cockeyed economic policies, using humans as production factors or sacrificing human beings for humanity's good or history's march. The Soviets executed perhaps around 10% of their more than 8 million killed. Had Mao not hatched his murderous Great Leap Forward economic scheme, then millions, indeed perhaps 20 million more Chinese, would not have died. None of this makes these regimes' murderousness any less murderous than the murderousness of others, or their victims' deaths any less morally condemnable, significant, or meaningful. But unlike those of the other colossally mass eliminationist and murderous regimes, the Nazis' drive to slaughter people was organic to their ideology, with its racist biological conception of humanity and human worth, and its concomitant drive for racial purity, expansion, and dominance. It was an ideology of destruction.